We turn back the clock and pull back the curtain on a seedy chapter in local history when gambling was king in no man's land. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with Billy Parks Burton, author of Turn a Blind Eye, and veteran Henderson journalist Chuck Stinnett. No one seemed to care about what was happening at the Indiana-Kentucky border until a reporter and a preacher joined forces. It's fact blended with fiction as we learn about crimes of passion, extortion, and government corruption. The community has become a haven of vice, but that's about to change as we follow the colorful characters of Hoyt Cole, Pearly, and Stormy Jack. 2 Main Street is next, presented by the Berger Wren Group at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. On this program, we turn back the clock and pull back the curtain on a seedy side of our local history. The 30s, 40s, and early 50s were heydays for organized crime. Parts of Evansville and Henderson earned the nickname Little Chicago. Nightclubs flourished with big-name entertainment, fancy menus, and top-shelf liquor, while dozens of neighborhood bars served the working classes with cheap booze and beer. Gambling, prostitution, extortion, and underage drinking all thrived when local officials turned a blind eye to what was going on. Well, how did this happen, and who led a crusade to clean up the crime and corruption? Well, we're going to find out. My guests are Billy Parks Burton, author of Turn a Blind Eye, and longtime Henderson journalist Chuck Stinnett. Welcome, guys, to 2 Main Street.
Hi, David.
Good to have you here. Now, our station here on the Evansville Riverfront is just blocks away from Waterworks Road and what was known as No Man's Land, a stretch of land between Evansville and Henderson, a mecca for the mob. Tell me about No Man's Land. Chuck, let's start with you.
Well, gambling was wide open. Local officials were certainly aware of it. There are allegations, some of them proven, that there were public officials who were on the take or had a stake in some of these establishments. And Bill has an interesting theory as to why it was tolerated the way it was. This was on the heels of the Depression. Henderson suffered a great deal during the Depression. Its largest industry, the cotton mill, had closed. One of its other large industries was a buggy factory, and the market for buggies in the 20s and 30s wasn't at all what it used to be. Of course, there was the Depression. Oh, and the dark tobacco market collapsed under tariffs. So Henderson was suffering in the 30s and 40s.
Anything to add to that, Bill?
Well, the no man's land aspect, I think, was a brilliant business decision made by a man named Clarence Wood. It was north of the river, still in Kentucky, but considerably outside the concerns of most of the law enforcement in Henderson, just because it was on the other side of the bridge. And it was several hundred yards away from the Indiana state line, so Indiana had no jurisdiction over it. So it was just a no man's land. And it was a brilliant business decision to place his gambling operations in that location.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, Turn a Blind Eye, there's a kind of a film, it's a film war novel about this lawless era. There's a hard-boiled newspaper reporter, a war veteran back home. He doesn't like what he sees, so some fictional characters, maybe based on fact?
There's a number of fictional characters, and a number of the events recounted in the book are fictional. At the same time, there are a number of characters that are based on real individuals and number of events that are based on actual occurrences during the era. Beginning in the late 20s up through the early 50s, as Chuck alluded earlier, Henderson was economically devastated. The Black Patch Tobacco Wars started in the 20s where the James Buchanan Buck Duke cornered the market on the dark tobacco market in western Kentucky and western Tennessee, and resulted in the Black Patch Wars and devastated the black tobacco market here. Then along comes prohibition in 1920 that pretty well killed the principal product that's used in liquor was corn, which was the way a lot of people, farmers, made a living in this area, and then comes the Depression. So one of the my feelings about why this occurred was after you go so long without being able to feed your family, whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, legal or illegal, drops way down in your area of concern. So the people, they were just, the principal person involved started out as a bootlegger because of all those economic circumstances that contributed to the poor living standard here.
Survival,
it was, yeah.
That's right. Now, the fictional reporter character, Hoyt, he finds an ally in a clergyman to organize the community to drive out the bad guys and expose the corruption. And there was a real-life minister who did just that. Tell me about Reverend Charles Dietze.
Charles Dietze was the minister of the Christian Church at that time, and he was also head of the Ministerial Association. And the fictional character Hoyt was directed to go to him and see if there's anybody or any group that could garner enough interest to confront the gambling faction that existed. And Dietze, along with one other man that I think was the principal impetus, in my book, it's the character is Walter T. Browder, who was a mechanic out in the East End, but his father was killed by the gambling impresario under questionable circumstances. And the Walter T. Browder character, based on a real person, took this as a personal vendetta to bring this man down. So he came to Hoyt, the character Hoyt, and he and his wife and a friend had gone to all the gambling establishments in the county, made a record of everybody that was turning chuckaluck, doing poker, got the serial numbers on all the machines, and had a wealth of knowledge.
And this is all based in truth.
That's all true. That's every bit true.
The reporter aspect is a fiction, but there was a man who wanted to avenge his father's death 8 years earlier, and he provided an inventory of illicit gambling equipment that made it harder to ignore.
So the courts couldn't ignore all this evidence.
Well,
they tried hard.
They did.
And it took... It really took, and Dietze's very responsible for getting the community support because it had become so insidious. Everybody was accepting of it. Nobody had taken any lead in trying to bring it to a close. So he had to get the community enraged enough to push and shove. And the fix was in legally, grand jury. You couldn't get anything past the grand jury, So all that had to be addressed, and Dietze was very instrumental in gaining and garnering community support over 18 months or 2 years. It took a while.
And he wrote a memoir called The Henderson Crusade about his efforts to clean up the community. Mm-hmm. And I think on the cover of that, they have like a crusader's sword through the gambling paraphernalia there.
I think that's correct. That was written in the early 1980s.
Yeah.
I got in touch with his son, Bill Dietze, who now lives in Fofftown, North Carolina, and got his permission to use his father's book as a resource. And I relied heavily on the book, particularly during the legal aspects of the...
Now, there's an infamous club in the book. You call it the Cosmos, I think?
Cosmopolitan.
Sounds a lot like the old Trocadero guys.
It's thinly based on the Trocadero. And, of course, I called it the Cosmo because the Trocadero was called by all people around here the Troc.
Sure, yeah, shortened the name.
And so, yes, that was a remarkable edifice here.
Yeah. What was an evening like at the Troc?
Well, it was intended, Clarence Wood, who owned the Trocadero, he intended it for it to be a fairly legitimate type of place. It was classy. There was no cover charge, but there was a minimum.
$2.
Which I think in today's dollars is something along the lines of $35. So not an exorbitant amount of money, but right. You were expected to spend money. Single men and single women weren't permitted. It was a couple's place. Gentlemen had to have a coat and tie. Unescorted women, absolutely not allowed. They had a ballroom, a dance floor. They brought in the best bands that they could be hired, Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington and the Mills Brothers.
Ink Spots. So many. There was nothing like it between Chicago and Miami at the time.
It was quite an entertainment palace.
So the who's who were there.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
They served excellent food. When I was at the newspaper in Henderson years ago, somebody brought me the cocktail menu from the Trocadero. It was about, 14 by 16 inches with cocktails drawn in color on both sides. So, you know, slow gin fizzes and old fashions, and they could sling a lot of spirits. I think a beer cost 25 cents, a cocktail cost 35 cents. So on the ground floor of the Trocadero, it's dining, it's dancing, it's drinking, and everything.
Upscale entertainment.
Upscale entertainment.
What about the back room?
Well, it was upstairs.
It was the upstairs.
Oh, okay.
The casino was upstairs.
Oh, okay.
And it was just as elaborate with its own bars and waitresses. But you couldn't just waltz in off the street and go up to the casino. You had to have permission to go to the casino.
What does that mean, permission?
Well,
like a password or something?
Well,
or?
No, that's my phrase, and that may be, of course, they wanted anybody that was willing to spend money to go up there.
Sure.
But as Chuck alluded to, you just couldn't walk in off the street, one guy, and roll the dice and leave. You had to have a lady with you and dressed appropriately. He did all he could to make it legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he intended ever for it to be a dive, and it wasn't.
No.
It was never. And I think Chuck tells the story. It's Chuck's story, but after it was all over with, and Clarence was still alive, he denied until his death that there was any gambling going on there.
Well, sort of.
Well, then finish. You can tell
okay.
it. When Chuck got ready to leave, he took him aside and handed him some dice that had the Trocadero on it.
Okay. The rest of the story.
So I was actually, we went to interview Clarence Wood late in his life. It was just a few months before he died at his home overlooking US 41 in Henderson. And he was in his three-piece suit. We did the interview in his downstairs bar with the glass block and the Christmas lights behind it. And it was kind of fancy in a fashion.
But fancy.
Indeed. And what he wanted to talk about was what a classy place it was. He wanted to show us his engagement book with the bands that performed there.
Oh, sure.
Just one after another. And every time the reporter on the assignment, Paul Nord, would ask about gambling, Clarence Wood would say, oh, that's just a story people told. There was no illicit gambling. Then he'd go back to talking about the big band. So it was kind of the story was kind of busting as far as we were concerned. So as we got ready to leave, Clarence Wood said, wait just a minute. And he reached under his bar and held out his hand to the reporter. And Paul put out his hand, and Clarence Wood dropped into his hand a pair of cellophane-wrapped, brand-new, Trocadero-branded dice.
Oh, wow.
Without a word being said.
So he acknowledged it there at the very end.
That's about as close as he came.
Right. Now, so gambling, drinking going on, big money makers for this club. Was there any drug trafficking going on? Was that
as far as I know, David? There was not. I guess it's a little bit naive to say there was not at all. But it wasn't the issue at all.
Right.
It was never the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Gambling was the biggest offender, and I raised the question in the book, and Hoyt ruminates over it and agonizes over it. You know, gambling was legal in Reno. Same action, illegal here. So was gambling in and of itself wrong, or was it wrong here because it was illegal?
Mm-hmm.
But that was the issue, and that was the big bugaboo that people attacked. It resulted in all the other vices that, you know, you turn your head and excuse one illegal activity, it becomes easier and easier to turn your head and excuse a lot of other illegal activities. And that's how the downward spiral occurred over 20, 25 years.
So you would have like politicians, physicians, lawyers downstairs having dinner with their wives, and upstairs you'd have these big-time rollers up there. So there was kind of interesting...
Well, and a lot of the same people that were downstairs ultimately went upstairs.
Oh, they did? Okay.
Yeah, they did. It wasn't two separate groups.
So they knew what was going on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah.
All right.
And yeah. Another facet of this was that these there were something on the order of maybe 60 or 70 places where illicit gambling was taking place in Henderson, a lot of it just outside the city limits. You know, U.S. 41 North at that time was not in the city.
Okay.
So that kind of contributed to even what's now called the North Strip was kind of no man's land because the city police had no authority there. The sheriff was an investor in the Trocadero, according to the newspaper accounts that I've read. But a lot of that gambling money came not from within Henderson, but from the much bigger city of Evansville, where the Trocadero and Clarence Wood had another saloon nearby, kind of more of a joint called the Dells. It was
on Waterworks Road, right off 41 there, probably not 200 or 300 yards off the highway, and it's set back in the woods. It was a down at the heels operation for that people who didn't feel comfortable at the Trocadero or weren't welcome at the Trocadero. The Troc was the epitome.
Okay.
And then the opportunities declined in class all the way down to, you know, some pretty low class places where a lot of strong arm tactics took place.
You probably identify the vehicles in the parking lot at the Troc and then go down to the Dells, and they might be a little lower class.
So you not only have the much larger city of Evansville to draw from, but during World War II and all the way into the 1950s, there was Camp Breckinridge 20 miles down the road at Morganfield with tens of thousands of young men who would occasionally get leave, and they'd come north to Henderson. Maybe not to the Trocadero, but to any of the various other joints.
All right.
It was importing wealth from Indiana and from young GIs. So
they would spend their money right there.
Sure. So mm-hmm. You know, it was a net gain.
That was an element that's addressed in the book. The Camp Breckinridge element. In fact, one of the scenes in the book is there's a major from Camp Breckinridge comes to Hoyt to put his commanding officer on public record that they opposed what was going on with these young soldiers. Mm-hmm. And there's a altercation involving one of them that's addressed in the book. But Chuck's absolutely right. There was no shortage of people that were anxious to take advantage of all that was going on here.
My guests are Billy Parks Burton, author of Turn a Blind Eye, and Henderson journalist Chuck Stinnett. Coming up, we're going to learn more about my guests and some of the colorful characters in the book, including Pearlie, Stormy Jack, and some new slang I've never heard before, Bill. Hard Ankle, Grass Widow, and Lemon Squeezer. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guests are Billy Parks Burton, author of the crime novel Turn a Blind Eye, featuring his hometown of Henderson, and riding shotgun on the show is veteran Henderson journalist Chuck Stinnett. And you're one of the reviewers on the back cover, Chuck. So what was your review of the book?
Well, as you said earlier, it's a very noirish type of book.
Dark.
If you like Humphrey Bogart movies, then this is a story for you.
It is. So that's kind of your encapsulating view of the book here. The cover of the book captures that noirish feel, doesn't it?
It does.
You got a sinister looking. Is it the same guy there, or different shots of him?
You know, raised that question with my wife this morning, David, and I hadn't noticed it until just recently.
Looks like the same guy.
But I think it's an AI treatment of the same guy.
Yeah.
In three different poses. But I think it's intended to be three separate men.
Sure.
But I think they It's an AI treatment of the same guy.
Well, he's kind of like hovering over the poker table, I guess, with a bunch of chips there, kind of looking at the next guy. What's his move going to be here? Is he going to raise? Is he going to fold? It's kind of an intimidating character.
No question.
And then down at the bottom of the cover, we have a shot of a vintage automobile, a sinister guy standing on the riverfront there. And is that supposed to be the railroad bridge back there? I don't know.
Well, I tried to include the river as often as I could in the narrative because I was raised on the river. Henderson is on the river. You can't live here and not be aware of the river. And I referenced the river several times in the book, so I liked that part of it.
Sure.
The character or the picture of the man standing there can be anybody you want him to be. It could be Hoyt, it could be an underworld character, but I use a big black Buick in an intimidating scene in the book. While that's not a Buick, it's a big black car. And the cover was designed by Scott Storz, Storz, from Butler Books.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's impressive. It really is. Now, let's learn more about my guests, Billy Burton and Chuck Sinnott. Bill, you are a retired pharmacist, an award-winning artist, now a novelist. So what prompted you to write this book?
Well, I'll give you more information than you want, and you can edit it out. But pharmacy is a kind of an analytical profession, very studious and accurately oriented. And I've always had a creative bent, painting. I like to write, and so I tell people my left brain, right brain, has always been in conflict, and so as a consequence, I'm not sure I'm good at either one of them. But
I think you're a splendid painter.
I like to paint, and as I aged, I started to write some essays, some people, things that the Gleaner published from time to time. So I'm getting long-winded to answer your question: why did I write the book? It was something that was pervasive in my childhood. I heard about these stories all my life. They were occurring in my pre-adolescent and adolescent years. And it, as Chuck alluded to earlier, it was a time in Henderson's past when there was no central air conditioning in homes and there was no television. So neighbors sat on their front porch and out in the yard and talked with each other. And they talked about the topics of interest of the day. And my father was a good storyteller. And he was plugged into the community in lots of ways. And so I heard about this all the time. And, you know, when you're a child, I use the insulting term and reference it to Mike Tyson, you're oblivious to what was going on around you. And I was. But I was aware of it and didn't care. You know, we were running and having a good time. But anyway, as I got older, I realized this is it was a tough time, and it was some real hard characters that had to survive during those days. I just found it interesting, so I used the Gleaner's archives, I used the library's archives, a couple of, in addition to Chuck, Frank Boyette from the paper, and there's another man whose name escapes me right now, but the paper was very. And there's a lot of stuff on the internet about this era and about the locale. So I didn't have to struggle too much for content. It was just a matter of how can I put it together in a readable form and in a form that will hold people's attention.
Yeah, the character development was very important there. And I think one of another reviewer, Jerry Rhodes, says, you use your words like a gifted painter uses a brush. I thought that was a nice review as well. Now, Chuck Sinnott, you're a member of the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame. Congratulations. Along with your wife, Donna.
Absolutely.
Both newspaper people.
Mm-hmm.
You were working at the Henderson Gleaner. Now you're a community leader and a freelance writer. So what fascinated you about this era?
Well, this book is largely, in my view, a vehicle for telling some really lurid stories, not just the illicit gambling that took place, But there were some really notorious crimes that took place. Some of them solved, some of them unsolved, that really held the public's imagination. And some of these involved murders involving passion and love triangles and perhaps improper behavior on the part of a victim and vengeance is taken out. And these are things that it really held the public imagination.
Sure.
Bill has I know that he heard those stories growing up. Everybody talked about it. There was one funeral in particular of a musician who was found beaten to death outside a nightclub. At his burial at the graveside service, there were like hundreds of people there. This just held this community's attention and probably the entire tri-state's attention.
That was Pearlie, I think, wasn't it?
Well, that's the character in the book.
Right.
Pearlie Martin is the character I use in the book.
Pearlie rhymes with Curly.
Curly.
Shelton.
Okay, there we go. Now, okay, you describe in the book, Chuck, as Nourish. How would you describe all this dark look at our not-too-distant past? We mentioned the love triangles and the seedy behavior. How would you describe a Nourish novel?
You know, it's certainly dark. You don't know who to trust in the story. I think you can trust Hoyt Bill's character, but... there's a lot of seediness going on. There can be backbiting. You never know if you're ever going to be safe exactly.
Everybody kind of covering their backs, aren't they?
They are.
They're afraid that's going to get out to somebody and they're going to get back and get revenge on you. Wow. And, of course, all this going on was great fodder for the newspaper back then, I'm sure.
Oh, for sure.
Some great headlines, I'm sure, back in those days.
Well, one of the conflicts in my book and is that Hoyt, while working for the local paper, finds it very frustrating that the owner never writes about it, never condemns it, which contributes to what Chuck was saying, trust. Mm-hmm. Right up until the end of the book, he has a good relationship with the owner and editor, and he has to take him into his confidence to get some things done. But right up until the end, when Hoyt is taken out and almost killed, he's wondering if his owner and publisher isn't somehow involved.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a matter of trust and suspicion and uncertainty.
Another memorable character in the book, I found this guy very interesting, Stormy Jack, shoeshine shop, I guess a stand, didn't he?
He's based on a very iconic and lovable character in Henderson of my childhood. His name was John Cloudy.
Okay.
He was a big man, a black man who had a shoeshine, actually a stand,
right,
on the corner of 2nd and Main Street. And he had gotten quite heavy as a young man and at one time was with a carnival and billed as the world's fattest man. He was weighed over 500 pounds. And the traveling and...
That's how he made his living, I guess, didn't
it? Well, the traveling and what have you got kind of... And he started to lose weight and he came back and set up this shoeshine stand. And I moved it inside to the Kingdon Hotel and I changed his name...
Sure.
To John Calhoun Storm, and he was then nicknamed Stormy Jack. But it was my homage to John Cloudy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John Cloudy, everybody in town knew John Cloudy. He was bigger than anybody else in town. Probably by the time he was running the shoeshine stand, maybe he weighed 300 pounds or something like
that. No more than that.
Mm-hmm. And it was, I understand that women, the mothers, if they thought they're child was overeating or eating too much candy, would say, "You keep eating like that, you're going to be as big as John Cloudy."
Oh, okay.
That was an admonition that I heard all my life.
And of course, in his profession, he got to hear a lot of gossip. What was going on around the town?
I tried to imply that he was a valid and credible source for Hoyt about the goings on in town. I imply that he would never repeat something that he didn't think was accurate. And he never divulged who told him what. So he was credible.
And he was a childhood friend of the owner of the Cosmopolitan.
In my book, he was. I don't think the two of them had a relationship in real life.
Okay. I'm sure he was aware of what was going on there.
Well, he couldn't. You couldn't live in Henderson as an adult and not be aware of it.
Right.
And the Kingdon Hotel didn't have the greatest reputation at that time.
It was a little bit down at the heels. It was older, in disrepair. Well, it was demolished in 73, and the Soper, the other downtown hotel, still stands.
Mm-hmm.
So the Kingdon was...
There were illicit activities, I understand, that took place at the
probably
Kingdon.
Probably so.
Right.
Probably so.
There was a grisly murder in the book, The Weapon, a spike maul. So what's a spike maul?
Well, if you can envision a sledgehammer with one side a sledgehammer and the other side with a pointed end on it. One of the things that I haven't addressed is the book is also a time compressed telling of events that happened in Henderson County, and that murder actually happened in the 20s in Henderson.
Wow.
And it happened out in the East End on Clay Street. The superintendent of two or three mines was killed by a man that he knew and that was stayed in their home a lot. And it was, as Chuck alluded earlier, a love triangle.
Wow.
And he was finally found guilty and sentenced.
Hmm. Now, some iconic locations show up in the book. Of course, the iconic railroad bridge. Everybody knows about that. The Soper Hotel. Dunaway's Drugstore. Was there a Dunaway's Drugstore?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was on the corner of 2nd and Elm Street. And that was the high school hangout for a lot of kids. It was three doors down from the Kentucky Theater. And so on Saturday, we would all congregate there.
So you were one of the people hanging out.
Hanging out at Dunaway's. Oh, yeah.
It was a soda fountain.
It had a soda fountain and a lunch counter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, some expressions. New to me, let's start with the slang term hard ankle.
Well, as I said, I like colloquialisms, and it's just a term that I'd heard all my life. And it's generally a reference to a rural boy or a boy that's grew up hard, maybe wears shoes with no socks. You didn't trifle with him. He just worked hard. He didn't have a lot of wherewithal. He just was worn down by his environment.
Okay. And a grass widow.
That was my expression my father always used. And as in your research, you know now, it referred to a divorced woman as opposed to a widow who had lost her husband by death. She'd lost her husband through divorce. And it was a polite way of saying she was divorced.
Grass widow, wow. And a lemon squeezer hat.
Well, you've seen them. They're trooper hats. They've got, you know, if you took it off your head, there's you can grab it by three or four fingers. You know, it's just a Smokey the Bear type hat.
Okay, describe these characters. Wow, the protagonist Hoyt Cole is upholding a longtime tradition of journalism, speaking truth to power, confronting authority figures. And sometimes asking those questions can get you make you some enemies. Hoyt is threatened, but he's no pushover, is he? He's a tough guy.
Well, he served in the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. and he joined the Marines on the 8th of December, the day after Pearl Harbor was attacked. And he served his tour in the South Pacific on islands Saipan and Tinian, and he was engaged in the cleanup of Nagasaki after we dropped the second bomb. So he had experience in the physical conflicts. And, you know, Marines aren't generally pushovers. And I don't think he was a violent man by nature, but he was easily provoked. And he wasn't going to be strong-armed.
Mm-hmm. Any people that you knew at the newspaper like that, like Hoyt?
Well, my editor for many years, Ron Jenkins, certainly was a scrappy fellow.
I remember Ron, yeah.
I think there was more than one occasion when he invited somebody to step outside to see if they could settle these things. And he had been an amateur boxer as a young man. He was a good athlete and a good boxer. I think he fought some of the soldiers at Camp Breckinridge in amateur bouts.
Now, when I was working at the Evansville Courier, I was a student at the University of Evansville at the time, working there part-time. We had a reporter there who was a crime reporter, and he carried a pistol with him on his rounds. And I don't think anybody messed with this guy, because he would go out to these scenes with the police right when something happened. You know, boy, they listen to that scanner or something. They're on there with the cops, and sometimes they run into some pretty tough situations. So that there's definitely some Hoyts out there in the history. My guests are Billy Parks Burton. He's the author of the crime novel Turn a Blind Eye, set in no man's land between Evansville and Henderson. Chuck Stinnett, of course, a veteran journalist and has a long career covering the news as a reporter, editor, and columnist. So, Chuck, one more question for you here. What are some of the highlights of your career covering Henderson events?
Oh, gosh. You know, so many spot news events. I remember early one winter evening, there was suddenly an explosion. I thought an airplane had hit the newspaper office. What had happened was that there had been a dust explosion at a grain elevator.
Oh, my. Yeah.
No more than a quarter mile behind the newspaper office. And there were actually grain elevator workers who were trapped, injured, seriously injured, and trapped upstairs. So if you've ever seen the show Emergency, set in Los Angeles with paramedic firefighters, there was a rather heroic rescue by a Henderson firefighter of men who were trapped upstairs. Naturally, it was cold, so we're out there shivering. And sure. I think the first thing that I did was I called 911 to report that there had been an explosion, and then off we ran to the grain elevator. Mm-hmm. I remember the period furniture fire. I think that was a New Year's Eve, 14 degrees, raging fire, a building full of lacquer and wood, and it was just an inferno. So cold that the ink in my ballpoint pen stopped working.
Oh my.
And that building was a total loss. Interviews with interesting people, silly columns that I wrote. I had a favorite column that I wrote about when I was dispatched on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving to the supermarket. It was raining outside. It's dark. It's cold. There's one grocery cart left. There's husbands wandering around who don't know where anything is in the grocery. So I wrote a humorous column about that.
Presidential visit?
Jimmy Carter came to town.
That's right.
It was quite a spectacle. That wasn't a cold day. That was a terribly hot day. My poor wife was about 7 months pregnant, but she was on assignment. She was positioned on Main Street to take a picture of Jimmy Carter and the motorcade. As it came through town, something that was memorable for a little town like Henderson.
Definitely. Now, still to come, Billy Park Burton's dedication in the book to three lifelong friends of the author who died in rapid succession. And Chuck Stinnett says Henderson has come a long way. Well, I'll say this for him. Has come a long way since being called Little Chicago, of course. We'll see what's going on in Henderson. This is 2 Main Street, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guests are Billy Parks Burton, author of Turn a Blind Eye About Crime and Corruption in Henderson in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and newspaper reporter determined to clean up his hometown. Chuck Stinnett is also here. He's a veteran journalist with a long career at the Henderson Gleaner newspaper. Now, when I opened the book to read it, Turn a Blind Eye, the dedication intrigued me, Bill. You mentioned three lifelong friends who died in rapid succession. What's that all about?
Well, they died mainly because they'd gotten as old as I am. Age took them. But they were friends from high school and grade school. One of them, we started in first grade together. And they were just men that have been in and out of my life all my life. Very, very good, reliable, humorous, trustworthy friends that I loved. And they all died within about 18 months.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a remembrance of them.
It was. None of them died suddenly. They mm-hmm. had, You know, I at my age, I talk about we all covet longevity, but longevity brings its own set of problems that you know. And if you died when you're 65, you don't have to worry about Alzheimer's. But as you age, things take its toll. And these men died of age-related maladies.
Okay, back to the book. Of course, gambling is the big problem here, turning a blind eye to what was going on. So tell me about the gambling culture, Chuck.
Well, something that I think needs to be remembered, while this is a very film noirish type book and the cover is very sinister, this was not really mob controlled. The gambling establishments here were quite local. Now, the real life Clarence Wood, he certainly was the kingpin. The late Oswald Posse Coombs was one of the fellows who ran a saloon in that era, and he wrote a couple of memoirs about it. I love the story he tells that his joint, as he referred to it, the Kentucky Tavern on North Green Street, that there'd be so many servicemen from Camp Breckenridge and local people drinking that sometimes a hand would just appear through the crowd with a quarter, and you would grab that quarter and stick whatever beer you could grab it, get your hands on first, and stick it in that hand and never see the face of the person who had bought it. So it could be kind of a frenzy. But this wasn't controlled by the Chicago mob or the Detroit mob. But in his book, tells a story that Clarence Wood one time brought in all of the owners of the lower rent gambling establishments. And he said, men, there's some people who are going to come in from out of town, and they're going to try to buy your businesses. If you sell to them, we have a good thing going, it's all going to fall apart. You've got to stand firm. Don't sell out. And nobody did, and the mob turned and walked away. So it might have been a little more palatable for Hendersonians to think that whatever illicit gambling was taking place was their illicit gambling.
So Little Chicago doesn't really apply to the mob in Chicago, did it?
It references the degree of corruption.
Sure.
Okay. Compares the degree of corruption in Henderson to what was going on during Scarface's tenure. What was his name, Chuck?
Al Capone.
Al Capone's tenure. Illicit gambling was going on all over the country. Newport and Covington, yep, in northern Kentucky was just as corrupt and just as notorious.
And I think more mob connected.
Probably was, okay. Yes. And the Kieffer Committee was charged with investigating illicit and illegal gambling throughout the country. And because Covington and Newport were close to Cincinnati, they got national attention. I guess they felt like Evansville wasn't large enough because they never did get involved in Henderson. And so Henderson was left just to kind of fend for itself as far as the cleanup effort is concerned.
Although there certainly were other outside forces. As Bill mentioned, there were complaints, and he described in the book that there's a complaint where an Army officer is unhappy with his men being fleeced at Henderson Joints. The IRS was also involved in the cleanup of Henderson in the 1950s because they realized it was tax revenue that they weren't realizing. The biggest newspaper in the state, the Courier-Journal of Louisville, wrote an expose about gambling in Henderson. So there were state and federal influences that helped with the cleanup as well. Another aspect I wanted to mention, though, something that I think made the illicit gambling more tolerable, was that it also helped subsidize entertainment, live bands. There were lots of saloons, taverns, bars that had live music. There was actually a lady who grew up in that era. She went to our church, who told me it was a lot of fun growing up in that era. A band would come in from out of town. A local girl might, date one of the musicians for a little while and have a little fun, and then he'd head out of town. And it was full of entertainment. There's no live music in Henderson much these days, but there was lots of live music and lots of dancing when dancing was really popular. So, she remembered it as just being fun.
It mm-hmm. it brought a level of sophistication to an otherwise rural community. Mm-hmm. It truly did, and you could you could get a steak dinner and a drink for $5.95. You know, and I mean that sounds just dirt cheap now, but it was relative.
Sure. You know,
but it was still the entertainment and the gambling provided a lot of things that Henderson would have otherwise not been able to experience.
Now, the Trocadero, Cosmopolitan, in your book, I think it was closed in 1951, or was it like around there? What was the demise of the Troc? How did that happen?
Well, when gambling went away, it just was couldn't sustain itself. That it was based on that, so he just locked it up. It wasn't economically feasible to keep it running. You couldn't bring in the bands and justify the cost of the bands. Clarence Woods, the owner, just locked it up, shut it down. And it sat there vacant for 30 years. As I started to say, I can remember driving back and forth across the bridge, and you somehow your eyes just always wandered over to that edifice sitting there. But it had some failed attempts to be used for, I don't know, various things.
An antique mall.
Antique mall. Right. One. There was a local card or implement dealer that generally tried to set it up as a nightclub, and it didn't last but about 6 or 8 months.
Was there a fire there?
It finally, a boiler burst or boiler broke or something, and it burned it down.
Wow. Now, there's a dramatic moment in the book where our hero, Hoyt Cole, big trouble with the local guys, but a female cop comes to the rescue. Now, we won't spoil the narrative, but tell me about this character, Deputy Catterjohn.
Well, I tried to include some socially conscious issues in the book. The Jim Crow South, as related to the Stormy Jack character, the dismissive use of female people in the workforce. She was took the civil service exam and scored higher than anybody had ever scored on it, and they hired her not ever having seen her or interviewed her. So, and this is a fictitious character. Mm. This is not based on anybody. I made this up. So once they realized she was a female, they just relegated her to nothing. You know, she just disregarded her, and she had a degree in criminology from Eastern University. She was credible. Hoyt recognized her worth. Mm-hmm. And that was just my attempt to try to put a little focus on women in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hoyt, there is a romantic interest involving Hoyt, a woman that he's known for years, but she's married to somebody else. So there's some conflict there as well. Kind of adds to the noir aspect of the novel.
Again, that was kind of a purposeful intent to try to, I guess, make the book a little bit more interesting to women readers. She was basically a high school girlfriend that when he went off in the service, she married somebody else. And as they come back together, she has a rocky marriage. And she turns to Hoyt in times of crisis, rekindling his love and interest. At the same time, it becomes very evident that she's not going to leave her husband. So it's a push and shove, bittersweet relationship that he has to contend with.
Nice tension going on there, definitely.
And ironically, that type of relationship factored into some of the great lurid crimes of Henderson in the mid-century.
It did.
That's right. So what's been the reaction to the book so far?
Well, locally, it's been well received. I tell everybody, all the reviews that I've had and people have spoken to me about it have been very, very positive. I have to acknowledge that probably nobody's going to come up to you and say, you know, I read your book and it wasn't very good. I didn't like it. So you don't hear that kind of feedback. But it's been positive. I've enjoyed the exposure, but I have to say the interest has been mostly local.
Mm-hmm. Chuck, what have you heard about the book?
You know, when you have an interest in local history, you figure that everybody knows these stories. But I think for some readers, the idea that some of these events might have actually happened, well, in fact, they absolutely did happen, is probably quite shocking. You know, every community has its problems and has its crime and has its scandals, but, you know, these are really very good times for Henderson. Henderson feels very good about itself. Its downtown is thriving. The restaurants are still busy. Can be a challenge to find a parking space.
Because you were with the Community Foundation, you're now no longer with the foundation, right? So you know what's going on in Henderson.
Well, I hope so. So I think it's probably rather surprising for people to imagine that a man might have murdered his best friend because he was in love with his wife and the wife was encouraging him to make this husband who was not very nice to her disappear. It probably is a little bit scandalous to them.
So what's next for Bill Burton?
Well,
any more novels?
David, I enjoyed the process much more than I thought I ever would, and I would like to write again. I don't have any idea that I'd ever be. It took me about 3 to 5 years to get this one out, so I don't know that I've got time left to get another one out. But I've been trying to find a storyline, and, you know, I guess Chuck knows better than anybody. If you enjoy writing, you don't have to write with the idea in mind of having a finished product. I enjoy the process. If I can find a decent storyline that I can pursue, that I can treat with some credibility, I'm looking, and I hope to find one.
Well, if you love film noir movies, crime stories, and quirky characters, you'll enjoy the exploits of our unlikely hero, Hoyt Cole. Cole, who has lost the love of his life. He's lonely, he drinks too much, suffers from combat fatigue, but Hoyt sees a haven of vice and is willing to risk it all to reclaim his hometown of Henderson. It's a good read. My thanks to Bill Burton and Chuck Stinnett for being my guests here on 2 Main Street. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.